Welcome to the ninth episode of Season 3 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Sunday the 6th of June 2010, and in this episode we've got another selection of interviews by Alan and Dave from the recent Ubuntu Developer Summit in Brussels. I'm Tony, and Laura's here with me. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
The good people we've got to interview in this episode are George Castro, Ryan Paul, and a quite long and a bit noisy interview with Jeremy Foshi. As you remember, they were recording the interviews all around the hotel on the last night of UDS. So I think by the time they got to Jeremy, there was a bit of a party going on in the background.
Well, at least they weren't standing outside the toilets on the Eurostar.
Well, yeah, been there, done that.
Okay, but first we've got an event to tell you about. It's called Ubuntu in Business, and it's happening on Tuesday, 13th of July, from 1 till 5 o'clock. So it's an afternoon event in London at the Brick House, which is in Brick Lane in London. And it's focused on business rather than community, so it's not kind of a gathering of sweaty geeks or anything. It's,
yeah.
It's meant to be... you might be an Ubuntu fan, but if it's sort of to the benefit of your co-workers, your boss, who want to know more about Ubuntu and what it can do for them in business.
Yeah, it's quite explicitly to promote Ubuntu to people who are in businesses, so... If you're looking at deploying Ubuntu or already have deployed Ubuntu, or you want to make better use of it or whatever, then this is an event to bring your boss or co-workers along to.
So there's going to be talks, I think, from people who do interesting things with Ubuntu already, like including our old friends, the Open Learning Centre.
Yeah, and Alfresco and possibly Zimbra and Unison and things. So some interesting projects. Sort of short 5-minute introductions from people who are doing things already with Ubuntu that might be of use to the business world.
And some demonstrations, food, yeah, and a bit of networking and a panel discussion.
Yeah, chaired by either Glyn Moody or our very own Alan Pope. And afterwards, as Laura mentioned, you can stay and enjoy an Ubuntini at the bar and enjoy it. It's a comedy venue, so there's a comedy night after this, so you can stay on by that. Alternatively, being Brick Lane, there are hundreds of really good curry places around there, so I suspect one of those might get a look in if you're going to that event.
Yeah, so they don't want loads of existing Ubuntu fans just turning up because it kind of defeats the object of the event. But if if you've got colleagues or a boss or someone that you're trying to convince, or they just want to know more, encourage them to go along to the event. It sounds like it'll be fun anyway.
Yeah, and there's an Eventbrite URL, which is ubuntuinbusiness.eventbrite.com, which you can sign up to say you're coming to the event. Well, I think that about covers all the details we need to know about that.
So let's get on with the interviews.
So with us today, we've got George Castro, and you're from the community team, I believe. And tell us a bit more about what you actually do with the community team.
Sure. So my name is George Castro. I'm the External Developer Relations Liaison, I think is the actual title, at Canonical Limited. I work on the community team. But generally speaking, the overall title that isn't so complicated is the guy who talks to upstreams. So that includes our largest upstream, which is Debian. And many of the other projects that make a distribution, so the GNOMEs, the KDEs of the world, application developers, that sort of thing.
So is that what specifically do you have to do with that communication? Is that fixing relationship problems, or is it just tying people together and that kind of stuff? What is that? How does that manifest itself?
Right. So simplistically, that involves if I were to say one simple expression, it's making sure the right people meet the other right people. So I do a lot of introductions at UDS, like in the beginning, and it's so I kind of do that. So once those people are connected, it's really my job to make sure that those channels are open. So this deals with things like bug and patch workflow, right? So every upstream is different. So it's a difficult problem, right? Some upstreams want to see every bug, some don't. Some want a filter, some want it reported on an external bug tracker, some want it in a mailing list, some don't want bugs at all. So that's just bugs, right? So we have that problem with patches, you know, translations, which is what David Planella does, and that relationship. So really, when I talk to an upstream, if the relationship is going good, I need to link each one of them up with my person in Ubuntu. So for example, Tomboy. Upstream needed a PPA. You were interested in, Alan Pope himself was interested in providing that service. So I basically linked them up, and now You know, they have a stable release PPA. What else do you have? Do you have nightlies?
A development one as well.
Yeah, a development one. And that lets me segue into my next big thing is we're going to start to offer daily builds for upstreams, sort of like as a service to help them test. So we are putting a lot of work into being able to give flexibility to upstream so that if you want to test a bug, we can give you pure untouched upstream available to users. Being able to have the distribution packaging and stuff, because a lot of upstreams like don't care about packaging, right? They're like, ugh, let a distributor do it, right? So, but you will be able to test like pure tip of trunk, testing the packaging that you know is in the distribution. And my personal favorite, which I'm really looking forward to, is let's say you're an upstream developer and you think you fixed a bug. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just click a button for the user and say, try this fix, and be able to generate a PPA on the fly for someone to just install that and see if the fix is fixed, and then you can just roll that back in. So it would be nice to be able to just make PPAs on the fly to fix individual bugs and have that all going back upstream where it goes.
Okay, so that's some of the more pleasant sides of your job.
Yeah.
But I'm going to imagine that with that comes some difficult situations of resolving conflict between Ubuntu and upstreams. What sort of conflicts do you encounter, and how do you go about fixing them?
Yeah. So usually, unfortunately, this is one of those roles where people focus on what goes wrong, right? And a lot of people ignore or don't know or don't care that when things go well. So usually, when I read on the internet, you know, it's always like, well, everybody knows that Debian and Ubuntu are, you know, the war and da 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 da. But like, as you'll see when you talk to the Debian project leader who's here at a UDS, and we also attend DebConfs and stuff, I'm going to spend this cycle myth busting with kind of my counterpart at Debian, Lucas Nussbaum. So, and we've been doing a lot of work together. We had a really great Debian health check session to talk about how to fix those kinds of things. And I'm really glad that Debian is open to collaboration. And this is an opportunity for us to really take the Debian system, quote unquote, the Debian system ecosystem to levels where, you know, we couldn't previously before. So I think before, like, people have explained it, right? They're like, Ubuntu is not a fork, it's a spoon and all that kind of stuff. And what we mentioned, you know, in the sessions is like, we're partners. And at the end of the day, yeah, we have the differences, but at the end of the day, we all care about improving free software.
So you mentioned earlier that different projects have different expectations from us about mm-hmm. About what goes to their bug tracker and things like right. that. How do you, because so, many community members do triaging and things like that, mm-hmm. How do they know where, you know, which projects want what from us?
Ah, so this is another passionate thing I'm about, and this is something that any of your listeners can do, because they're probably already doing it and don't even know it. So, like I was saying, you know, upstreams like to have a person. They're like, yeah, Popey, he's my guy in Ubuntu that, you know, tell me. So we have a program called Adopt an Upstream, where we basically have a list of packages that need help, right? And an upstream, someone who adopts an upstream becomes like an ambassador, right? And they have one foot in each camp. So they understand upstream's release schedule, right? They hang out in their mailing list and their IRC channels. And on the flip side, they also do that. So he's the person that sits in the channel and says, when someone goes, does anyone know when Ubuntu's freezes or whatever? And he's the guy that knows where the schedule is, right? And explaining what the freeze points mean and things like that. So a lot of people are already doing it. So usually when I talk to people who are doing that, I'm like, that's important. I would send them an email, right? And then I realized that, you know, if we have one place, because, you know, there's a lot, people are a lot smarter than me. Well, you guys already know me, so you know that. So we started consolidating in, you know, wiki.ubuntu.com/upstream. So if an upstream asks you what our stable release process is, boom, here's how we roll when it comes to our core beliefs. Boom, here's our governance, things upstreams might be interested in. So to give those tools to the upstream ambassadors so they can do a good job. So this is where we're going to say, have you talked to your upstream about daily builds and their benefits, right? And then they'll click that link. It'll take the pros and cons and that kind of stuff to kind of empower upstream to make the decisions on the stuff they want to do, right? Like, I heard about this Ubuntu libapp indicator thing. How do I get in with that? You know, oh, boom, your upstream contact will have all the knowledge he or she needs to make that happen.
Okay, so this Adopt an Ambassador upstream project that you're undertaking, how do people actually go about applying for that sort of responsibility?
Right, so we had a session on this. So a lot of this was actually done by Sensei Hofstadter. I can't pronounce it, but so when we first started this past cycle, it was kind of like, you know, oh, it's an idea, right? And but it started to become so popular that, you know, the big grid of lists on the wiki, you know, put your name in if you do this and you have to go update that in a big list of packages, that's not going to work. So we're gonna figure out, we have it in the spec, but I can't remember off the top of my head, on how to make that scale, right? So this cycle, we were able to get the people who are really passionate about the few things. Now we've kind of figured out how to make that scalable and roll with that.
So you mentioned we're here at UDS and there's lots of sessions going on throughout the whole week. Mm-hmm. Are there any particular sessions that you've been really keen to go to, or that have turned out, you know, better than you expected, or things you're looking forward to in Maverick?
So the Chromium one was one of the top ones. So I've been a fan and a believer. And Evan Martin from the Chromium team attended. And it was interesting because in a lot of ways, we were just talking about this, is that Chromium is like a web app. Right, the concept of, you know, a stable maintained thing with backported fixes, like the old school Debian way that I've known my whole life, right? And but they're like a web app, you know, when they roll, they want all those fixes out to people. So naturally, that's just two different. There's, you know, so we were talking about ways to make that better for users. And
so that's like on the Windows version of Chrome and Chromium, and even on Linux as well, the kind of auto-update thing that bypasses whatever package management you might have, how to resolve that issue.
Right. So one of the things, I forget who said it, it could have been me, as I said, you know what, on my fiance's Windows laptop, I know that she's always going to have the latest browser, right? So since we're all geeks, right? You go to your parents for Christmas or whatever, and then you go and there's like billion updates and all that stuff. So when I install that for my parents, you know, I know that they're always going to be protected and up to date and all that stuff. And that's kind of scary though, but I think it's a paradigm shift there. You know, I mean, that might not work for some projects and others, but from looking around at people's screens, I think people love it.
So is there a plan to still use that feature and not and bypass the package management in Ubuntu?
So I can't really speak to that because a lot of those questions are pending. But for sure, there's plans in the Software Center to make it easy for you to get the Google Chrome from Google itself. But there's no reason we can't have a good experience with Chromium, because it's still important that people get the free software version of that, you know, if they choose.
One of the other things that's happened at this UDS is the selection of applications that are going to be in Maverick.
Yeah.
And I know you're a big time fan of Banshee, and we're sticking with Rhythmbox, but
yeah,
we've also changed from FSpot to Shotwell. What do you think about those kind of decisions that have been made?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the Yorba guys, they make Shotwell. I met them last year at Guadec, and they showed up very, very smart. But they had no idea how Linux worked, you know, and how getting stuff on the desktop worked. And I'm amazed at the progress they've made. And I think people are going to love it. This is going to be one of the ones that I'm going to try to get in the daily builds as soon as possible. So I think they've done an impressive job. On the flip side, FSpot now has a maintainer. So Ruben showed up Thursday, he's encouraged in a way that you know, will revive the FSpot project as well. So
it's still in the repository, so people can still use it if they want to.
Right, exactly. And I think give him a little bit of time. Those of you who know Ruben from Banshee already will know that FSpot also has a bright future. I'm really excited about it. So, and yeah, it's fantastic.
Anything else you're looking forward to in Maverick?
Yeah, so I you know, speaking of other sessions and all that kind of stuff, so you only ever get your fraction, right? I was delighted to hear that we're going to be providing a way for people to get updated versions of Upstream software on the stable release. It's easy to use. So, you know, right now we tell people enable backports and installs all this other stuff, and you only wanted the one thing. So I think that's fantastic.
Great. Thanks for talking to us, George.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
We're here with Ryan Paul, who is a journalist and software author. What brings you to UDS, Ryan?
I'm working on Glibber, the open source microblogging client included in Ubuntu Lucid.
And you're the author and sole maintainer?
I created the project in 2007. It's been my primary free time project since then. I'm still the lead developer, but I get a lot of help from Ken Van Dyne and other people who are part of the Ubuntu community.
What motivated you to start the project?
It started out as an experiment. I wanted to have a real-world software development project that I could work on so that I'd have a more hands-on understanding of application development. I could convey some of those ideas to my readers and just give them more insight into the development process and emerging technologies.
So what does Glibber actually do? I mean, how would the end user actually see it, and what features does it have?
Well, users configure their social networking accounts. Once they've done that, they can see streams of all of the messages from the services they use. So it brings together Twitter, Identica, Facebook, Flickr, and a number of other services into like a coherent, streamlined user interface with combined streams and duplicate message detection and a number of other features that are somewhat unique.
And what made you choose that as your starting point for a project to get your hands into development? Why that?
Well, it kind of grew that way. I have a lot of little tiny software projects that I was just experimenting with, things I was using to test specific technologies, and this is just the one that people found compelling and started using. But I think that a big part of it is just that When I got on Launchpad, when I started, that's actually how it started. I decided I wanted to test Launchpad, mainly George Castro pushing me to try it. So I put the project there, and suddenly everybody was using it. And I think, once again, that's George to blame. But yeah, it just exploded in popularity beyond my expectations very quickly. And, you know, pretty soon people were submitting patches. So, you know, it became clear that it was a good candidate for, a real world project.
And you support multiple protocols for different websites, Twitter, Identica, as you mentioned. Has it been hard to keep up with those? Do they change their APIs? Is it something that's a bit of a headache for you in a product that's sitting on a platform that's supported for a number of years, such as Ubuntu?
Yeah, that's been a big problem for us. There are a lot of API changes. The web services are still evolving, and they compete fiercely with each other. And, you know, as part of that, they kind of change their model incrementally over time. Facebook just launched a whole new set of APIs. Twitter is going to be deprecating their standard authentication protocol in a matter of months. So there are a bunch of these changes that are going to make it difficult to maintain. But, it's a lot of work, but we're really committed to doing it. And, you know, it's just a matter of finding a reasonable number of services that we can support and not pushing too hard and pushing too much into it. But, yeah, I think that it's doable in the long run. It's just challenging.
Now, the project's evolved quite a lot over the time, from what I've seen, but there's been quite a lot of under-the-surface things. I understand there's a service daemon as well now. What benefit does that actually give us?
So the point of splitting Glibber, decoupling the front end from the back end, basically, and creating the service daemon, was to make it so that Glibber's underlying functionality can be made accessible to the broader Ubuntu platform. This is part of Ubuntu's Social from the Start initiative. We don't want Glibber to just be a social networking application. We want third-party software on the desktop to really be able to leverage social networks and bring the user's information from the web to the desktop. And I think that it's not quite as visible in Lucid because we're still at a really early stage of Social from the Start development. You see it in the Me menu, among other places. But during this cycle, a big focus is going to be adding support for Glibber's social networking capabilities to additional applications. I think users can expect to see that in Maverick. Today we talked a lot about that during the UDS session, particularly things like adding a button to Rhythmbox so you can say, you know, tweet what I'm listening to, or allowing users to promote software they like from the Software Center and share it with their friends. So I think there's going to be more integration points, and all of that depends on the availability of the GWBR daemon running as a service that's accessible to the whole platform.
During the Lucid cycle, and to be fair, a little bit before, there's been some a lot of fairly rapid development of GWBR, obviously getting ready for being shipped on the CD by default. And it certainly went through some turbulent times. And has that turned it from being a spare time hobby project into something a bit more? Has it eaten a lot of your time? Have you managed that?
It certainly has taken a lot more of my time. And I think getting it ready was a big challenge. I think now that it's in there, I think that it's probably going to be less time consuming. But it did create some friction for me with, you know, my day job. And it was really hard to balance that and make sure that I didn't take too much time on it. I had to take some vacation days just to make sure that I got all the bugs done. And it was a lot of work. But, you know, I think that it's worth it in the long run. I think that another one of my major goals, the cycle, should be to really document it more so that we can get more community involvement so that it's not just me maintaining all of it.
So if people want to actually get involved with actually helping you actually maintain and develop it, how should they do that, and what do you want from them?
Well, you know, I think that the best way is to look at the roadmap for 3.0. We have a list of bugs that are flagged as part of that milestone. And if any users are interested in contributing, they can look at that and find one that's not being worked on. They can ping me on IRC or wherever and start talking about which ones they want to tackle. But we also welcome contributions from people who want to develop and maintain support for additional services. There are several more that we would like to add, and it's just a lot of work to maintain them. So, you know, we would prefer if somebody's going to contribute that they're going to stick around and help. That would be great.
Okay, so what's your Freenode username, and where's the project actually based? Where can people actually find this roadmap?
Our IRC channel is actually not on Freenode. We're on irc.arstechnica.com in #GWBR. That's where we can be found on IRC. And I'm there most of the day, so people ping me, I can get them rolling on development. We host a project on Launchpad, so just Launchpad, search GWBR, it should be right there. Though we have quite a few people posting branches and stuff like that, so you know, it's just not that hard to get started.
You mentioned your IRC channel being Ars Technica, and obviously your day job being a journalist for Ars Technica. It's quite obvious you have a passion for Ubuntu in some way, because you know the fact that you're developing for it, and you cover it quite a lot on the site. What's the motivation for doing that? You know, most tech sites tend to focus on, you know, Windows or OS X or something else. What brings you to talk about Ubuntu so much?
Well, Ars Technica, we have a very broad set of topics that we cover. We have dedicated editors who focus on specific topic areas. Some of my colleagues focus on Windows and OS X and gaming and hardware stuff, and I am the Ars Technica Linux editor, Linux and open source software, so that is my specific coverage area. And I try to cover topics in the open source area that are of interest to the readers, and it seems like Ubuntu is something that's just taken off. I'd say that of the open source coverage, articles about Ubuntu are by far the most popular. So I try to cater to that.
And how does that compare to non-Linux sections of your audience?
Hard to say.
Or you don't know. Or
like in terms of the other categories other open
source topics? Yeah, so you know, there's obviously a large number of people who visit the Ubuntu pages and read Ubuntu articles. How does that compare with, you know, audience figures for, you know, Windows and Mac? Are they, you know, skywards and we're trifling, or is there some kind of parity there?
No, I think that we're actually pretty close in terms of parity. You know, the one metric that might be relevant, at the end of the year 2009, we published a list of the most popular articles on the site for the year. And, you know, part of that, we published a list of the five most popular feature-length articles. These are full-length reviews. The Ubuntu Karmic review was the fourth most popular feature-length article on the site following the Windows 7 review and the Snow Leopard review. So it's right up there along with those.
Wow. That's great to hear. Well, thanks for talking to us, and good luck with the further developments on GWIBA.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So I'm here with JFO, Jeremy, who works for the kernel team. What do you do for the kernel team?
I am the resident bug wrangler. I'm the person who takes care of all defects reported against the kernel package for Ubuntu.
When you say defects, what does that mean?
Usually launchpad bugs. But I have bugs against the kernel package, bugs against UDEV, bugs against a number of packages.
And are they bugs that you've reported personally, or bugs other people?
No, these are bugs that the community has reported. Folks who've tested the distribution, they've encountered some specific problem. It may be a one-off in most cases. Generally, we've fixed them with updates from stable kernel. But a lot of the time, we find that some folks are affected by specific issues that we need to look at.
So these could be hardware-related issues. So specific laptop or desktop-type PC with some obscure hardware.
Definitely.
What is it that users can do to make it easier to help you guys?
Certainly. Well, what we're doing now, part of this UDS, is that we're going to try and get the Launchpad team to shut down the ability to mark duplicate bugs, at least initially. The thinking is that hardware, even hardware that seems similar to other hardware, could be affected by a specific bug that we've not seen yet. We find that in some cases, bugs that have a large number of duplicates, when we push a fix for that specific bug, we find that not all bug reporters are fixed by that. So instead of having to deal with those specific issues where they've not given us apport collected data, we want them to generate a specific bug report for their issue so that we can deal with it specifically.
That sounds kind of counterintuitive to some people who are told, look for bugs first.
Precisely.
Find a bug and then mark it as a duplicate.
Well, and this is a brand new approach. So the kernel manager, Pete Grainer, has actually decided that it's in our best interest to remove the ability for apport to detect duplicates and the ability for a user to mark a duplicate initially. The decision was made because we have a kernel bug triager myself who actually will need to go through with the kernel developers to identify those bugs that are in fact duplicates, simply because this way we get more detailed information as far as hardware goes.
And how would a user know whether something is a kernel bug or not?
Well, generally we find that users are notified by apport when something happens that apport deems as a bug. They may not know exactly what happened, but apport tells them you need to file a bug. In these cases, generally what happens is the kernel detects an error that it's able to bypass, but it's letting the user know that there's something they need to report that they need to let the developers know about so that we can remove it and hopefully take care of a potential situation before it actually becomes a situation.
And I understand you're doing some work in relation to USB keys. And
yes.
What's going on with that? Tell me more about that.
Well, this is something brand new. So as you know, we have the checkbox tool set. And we had some issues with checkbox in the past that the QA team was working on. And we wanted to get some really good metrics from conferences and user groups that we encountered during the Lucid cycle. So we developed a specific testing suite that goes on a live ISO image that I've been taking around the country and around the world, actually, to user conferences, where we can take user hardware there, run a live ISO image, and run a series of tests against the kernel, suspend or zoom being the main one, to see what hardware we find in the field that we can fix for before we release a software product.
What's special about the ISO image that you use, different from the normal desktop live CD that people would be familiar with?
Well, actually, in order to save space, we remove the OpenOffice package, which doesn't really have an impact on the kernel. And then we apply our own set of tools we call the kernel QA. And what basically happens is we change this image from something that you can install from to an image that when you boot it, it runs into a session with the Ubuntu user and it starts a terminal and gives you a series of tests that you can then run. We gather that data via apport, tools that we've already got available, and then we will upload that to a hardware database for us to use prior to beta and release candidates in order to take care of the most encountered issues that we find.
What kind of information are you gathering? Is it a hardware database, you know, this is all the devices attached to the system, or is it more detailed?
Well, and in fairness, I said the hardware database. This is not really that. The hardware database is something that certification uses. The database that I'm referring to is more a kernel-specific one. We pull DMI decode information to find out system bus and hardware cards and things like that that are different across different hardware platforms. And this helps us kind of drill down to identify trouble hardware or things that actually need quirks that we may have missed in a stable update. So we're not pulling user information, we're not pulling any kind of sensitive data, no IP addressing, anything of that nature, mainly hardware profiles.
And so this is something that your team internally has developed, a sort of special live CD.
Yes,
and
actually,
something you're going to make publicly available?
Yes, absolutely. So the hope with the kernel team is that we'll have a wiki page, hopefully over this next cycle, that identifies for locos how to create new tests, things that they find are actually relevant in their areas, some things that we may not have thought of, that they can add to the test, submit to the kernel team, and we'll add it to the overall test suite. Also, we're going to try and get this out so that when we have global jam days, these groups are able to actually do some testing around their local areas, and we find that very useful.
So people could take a CD or a USB key, stick it in basically any random computer, gather information about that computer, and then submit that back to you guys.
Yes, exactly. And this even allows them not to necessarily file a bug, especially on the development software. If this is something that we're actively developing on, maybe we can fix it before they do an installation. That's our goal.
So the goal is zero effort.
Absolutely.
It's just a bootable stick and you're off.
Precisely. There's no impact on their hardware at all.
What sort of time scale have you got on making something available so that loco teams, which have huge numbers of users who visit huge numbers of people with computers of massively varying types, what sort of time scale are we talking about?
Well, right now I have a system where I can generate manually an ISO image, but what I want to do is something similar to what the kernel has done with the mainline PPA and with the kernel PPA, where we actually generate a daily build of the kernel and a daily build of the live ISO that's generated nightly. So the scripts that I have actually take the ISO and open it up, take the parts out that we don't need, add our parts back. So you have the potential to test a daily image with the testing software. And we haven't had the opportunity to do daily images and test them, but we think that that would be immensely useful to a lot of teams. So that's our goal right now. In addition to which, I'm planning over the next 6 months to do what we call a triager summit. It's going to be purely electronic, something like Open Week. And we're going to take our subsystem triagers, the people who seem to be interested in a specific subset of the kernel, for instance, audio or graphics or something of that nature, wireless, and we're going to give them an opportunity to learn from our subject matter experts on triage, people from other teams who have been triaging kernel bugs for a while. And we're hoping that this will be sort of the first step into sort of a career training path in free software towards kernel development. If we can get triagers to the next step, and then the next cycle we get them to the next step, and we get the first folks to the first step, then we have a process by which we're training people in free software online, potentially on the weekend, where they're able to provide more support from a software and a bug triage perspective so that they can step forward in their potential career as kernel developers.
Is there any way that people can find out more about the kind of activity that you're doing, this ISO image testing and
Absolutely.
Other stuff?
Absolutely. So we've taken on an action item. Actually, I've taken on an action item where we're actually doing what we call wiki gardening. The kernel team's pages have been stale for a time. And this past cycle, I didn't get quite the opportunity I was hoping for to take a look at them and bring them up to relevancy. But what we're hoping to do is, a part of our new kernel wiki pages, we're going to actually garden the things that we have and clean them up to a point where they can be archived data. We're going to start from Maverick, and we're going to build new pages for the stuff that we're doing now, kernel triage, advanced development on the kernel, advanced triage on the kernel, advanced tracing on the kernel. We've got a lot of action items from this UDS that we're hoping to put into these new pages. And as a result, I've actually talked to the forums moderators so that we can get real-time data on trending topics that they're seeing, because currently, kernel developers don't look at the forums, and we're missing a great resource.
When you talk about the forums, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect. As you say, the developers don't read the forums. Why do you think that is? Why do you think developers don't seem to go there. What is it that stops them?
Well, historically, we've left the forums as a user base. Users helping users. We want the community to become empowered in a way where they can help their associates when they encounter bugs and things that have solved them. If they're able within forum topics to say, this is what I've done to fix me, then the chance is great that we'll not have to open a bug for that specific issue if it's something that requires a quirk. The difficulty's been the Ubuntu kernel team suffers from the fact that we have a limited number of people and a massive number of bugs. And we're not quite the same as the upstream kernel in that we don't necessarily do kernel fixes. What we're mainly tasked with, being that we're distribution-centric, is that we pull in stable updates, we verify that they build successfully, we test them on the hardware we have available, because currently QA doesn't really have a facility, we're working on that, to deal directly with the kernel as far as testing goes. They have some tasks, but the difficulty is if the kernel developers haven't tested a specific thing, which we usually try to do, then the QA will sometimes miss those things. And it's not because there's a hole in their process, it's because we don't currently have the facility to take care of those specific edge cases.
So some of this is outreach to the,
yes,
to
absolutely.
The forums. And are there specific issues with the forums? I know there's been people posting information about how to deal with certain kernel issues on the forums, and it causes issues when some of that information gets stale, for example.
Yes.
And how are you going to deal with that kind of problem?
We've actually worked with the owner of the forums. We're going to do a bit of a session with the moderators themselves and kind of give them some information where if they see trending kernel topics, where they see people maybe giving some questionable information, it's not necessarily that they're completely wrong, because we know that users as a rule are generally helpful. They try to help, you know, the person next to them who's having a similar issue as them. But what we would really like to do is for them to take that sort of with a grain of salt, to take a look at the official wiki documentation, and our effort is going to be geared around updating that information to a point where it is absolutely useful across the broad range of ability for kernel people. So we have some people who are at a specific level where the kernel tells them they need to file a bug and they didn't know the kernel existed until then. I want it to be really easy for them to file a bug and for us to deal with it, rather than for them having to read a lot of wiki pages to learn about the internals of the kernel when they don't necessarily care about that.
What's the ideal situation for an end user? Like, take my mum, for example.
Certainly.
She's like a complete end user, barely used a computer longer than a month, and she may encounter a kernel-related bug.
Mm.
She has no clue what kernel is. She has no clue what Linux is. As far as she's concerned, she boots into Ubuntu, and she sees this brown stuff in a lot of applications. How can we help those people? Because we have like this concentric circle of, you know, people in the middle, like yourself, who are very involved, and then we've got community people, and then we've got people
that are peripherally involved.
Yeah,
right.
Involved. How can we help them to either contribute or help us to help them?
Well, our current model, unfortunately, expects there to be someone kind of close by that knows a bit about the way Launchpad works, the way the kernel works, even if it's a minor bit of knowledge more than the original reporter. What we're hoping to do is actually make ourselves available. Currently, the kernel team, we've closed down. We had an open channel for the community, and we had a closed canonical channel where we talked about various issues behind the scenes. But what we've done is we've closed the internal channel, and we're entirely on the external channel now. So whereas a lot of our packaging and just general discussion that we thought may not be interesting from a user perspective now goes on in the public channel. So even if users are what we refer to as lurkers, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but just folks who want to listen and see if they catch something that's useful to them, then we want to make sure that we're accessible. So one of the things that I'm going to be doing very soon, I'm going to be on a sort of a barnstorming evangelical type user conference.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, exactly. To where we go out and we sort of do kernel myth busting. Because we suffer
from... What kind of myths are you thinking about here? What misinformation is there out there?
The difficulty is in the past, in the recent past, in the distant past, folks have regularly dealt with an upstream that was not open to end users filing bugs on a kernel. And it's not necessarily the fault of upstream, it's not necessarily the fault of the bug reporter. But what we're hoping to do is to provide a safe place for someone to come in and say, you know, I don't understand a lot about the kernel, but I have a quick question. Here's my problem. What should I do? And generally from the folks that I work with, I can tell you these are teddy bears. So if you're in the Ubuntu kernel channel and you say, I have a problem and all I want is someone to just say, just point me in the right direction, then these people are absolutely willing to do that.
So the common misconception is that Linux, especially kernel developers, are very distant, very
notoriously
hard to talk
grumpy.
To. Yeah,
yes.
Very hard to get hold of. Are you trying to change that perception?
Well, it's not so much change the perception as much as make them realize what's actually true. I've been here since January, and I've never had a situation where I, even working on the kernel team, if I come up with what I would consider a sort of newbie question for these people, I've never had a situation where they did not sit down and discuss with me the complete issue to include things that I didn't understand peripherally. So if they're telling me about building a kernel and I don't know what they're talking about when they say build these, they will go into extreme depth to make sure I understand what the deal is. And I've seen them do that for users that come in the channel, and I've tried to foster that environment. I've tried to help them understand that, you know, we are dealing with a changing user base. We are dealing with a changing bug reporter. I've seen over the last few months, I've seen bug reports from people who didn't know how to install a mainline kernel, even though I gave them all the information and they had access to the wiki page. So I've had to give a little bit of a higher touch to them, and I understand that's going to be something that's going to continue on. So what I hope to do is I hope to go to these sessions and tell loco teams how to address these issues with these users, how to make sure that they understand that we're not here to scare them away, that we're not here to yell at them when they don't know, we're not here to flame them when they ask a question that's legitimate. So the team itself has taken on an action item to actively go out and seek to help the end user, and that's what I want to foster as well.
What's the ideal, by the end of this cycle, by Maverick, what's your ideal end goal? What do you want to see happen?
Well, it's actually a multi-part goal. I hope to have knocked back our bug queue. Right now we're over 10,000 bugs for kernel packages.
Wow.
I hope to knock that back to half. The biggest problem is that
how are you going to find people to help you do that?
Well, sadly enough, I'm having to do it programmatically. So the way I'm addressing that is I'm going against those bugs that have not been touched for quite a long time, and I'm asking for a bit of an update. But I'm providing them with information that says, you know, understand this is an automated message. If you're not clear on why you're getting an automated message, please see this wiki page. But we're not trying to barrage them with a broad range of information. We're trying to give them specific details and further reading links. So we're trying to give it in digestible chunks. So at the same time, we're trying to touch those bugs that we know have been stale for quite a long time, simply because we've been really overwhelmed with the amount of kernel work that we've had to do. Most people don't understand that we have to do specific sauce patching for the kernel that Ubuntu carries for Ubuntu packages that we carry as a distribution.
And I understand you're trying to reduce that number
yes.
of delta patches from the upstream kernel.
And that was one of the sessions that we had here as well. The idea being that we want to carry the most relevant patches that we can use then to have valid debug information, maybe more in depth, so that some of our higher level triagers, the ones that we're hoping to train as a result of this triager summit, will have some information that they can go on, you know, new information that they can use, new tools in the kernel that we provide and things that we're trying to upstream as far as tools and utilities go. And as I have to tell you, it's very exciting stuff. I mean, I'm really excited about this next cycle. I wasn't here for the previous UDS, so this is my first one, but I know some of the stuff that we've done has been really hard work this past cycle. And I know a lot of the things that we've done, we've gotten tremendous buy-in from other teams, Launchpad team, the QA team. A lot of people are on board to make this next cycle a tremendous success.
Fantastic. So if people want to get involved with this and, you know, help out, what's the best place to go? Is there an IRC channel, wiki page? Where's a great central point?
Well, they have a number of avenues. our previous wiki pages were wiki.ubuntu.com/kernelteam with capitals on the K and the T. We've changed that now. We're going to be wiki.ubuntu.com/kernel with a capital K. That's where our new pages are going. That's where we're going to update our information. You can look there and find me. My name's Jeremy Foshi. I'm JFO on IRC. I'm always available on IRC. You can ping me and I will respond. Conversely, I think my email address is on there, but if it's not, it is Jeremy, J-E-R-E-M-Y, .F-O-S-H-E-E, at canonical.com. So you can send me an email, you can ping me on IRC, you can file a bug. Chances are I will definitely talk to you.
Phone number? Address?
Well, you know.
Very much.
I have to service users around the world.
Leave it there. Thanks very much for talking to
us. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a bit more of a normal show and the last of the interviews from UDS. In the meantime, you can get in touch with us via email, Twitter, Identicare and all the rest. Details are on the website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye-bye.